Het laatste rondje is gegeven.
Evie, die periode is al lang voorbij.
Nu de rode vlaggen neergehaald zijn en de roze olifant op stal, neem ik jou verder mee in mijn zoektocht naar een nuchter leven.
Maar de kunst is nu om nuchter te blijven.
Klopt. Je weet ondertussen wat we hier in mijn sober salon serveren. Straffe getuigen, coaches, auteurs, acteurs, muzikanten, podcasters, tips en tricks, maar vooral verhalen van jou en mij. Je hoeft helemaal geen probleemdrinker te zijn om in dit Stopcast-programma te stappen.
Alcoholalarm. Een podcast die dieper kijkt dan het glas.
Seizoen
4.
Belgian Podcast Award winner. Upcoming talent. Alcoholalarm. Met Evie Heindrichs.
Hi, warriors. Normally, you're not used to I'm speaking English, but this is an exceptional interview, so sorry for my English and advanced. I'm not in the Sober Saloon studio, but I'm invited in the Sheraton Hotel. Yes, first I want to thank the location here for their hospitality, but also Glenn from Making a Podcast, maakeenpodcast.be, and the guy who make pictures, Bart.
Yes.
But when you ask me where my sobriety brought me, end up in an hotel with Mr. Dan Carity.
I love that.
Thank you. Welcome.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, you not take the flight especially for the podcast, but you're here for another reason also.
I was here for some book promotion and a couple other little things I'm doing, but I would have flown in for the podcast for sure.
Thank you very much for that. Because your book, you tell it already, was a Booktopia. The title of your book is If I'm Being Honest. Mm-hmm. And how's it running?
It's going great. The reception of the book has been fantastic. but my favorite thing about it is at the very end of the book, I have an email there and I ask people, any kind of thoughts you have about the book, good, bad, indifferent, you know, please send me some messages. And what I've been receiving from people who are struggling themselves or know someone who's struggling, just the feedback I've been getting, the questions, everything, it's just been pretty overwhelming, but pretty awesome that it's reaching that many people.
So everybody is listening now can attach to you, can reach you?
Absolutely.
That's cool.
You know, I that's my favorite thing.
Yeah.
You know, in sobriety, is connecting with people. And, you know, no matter what your issue is that you're going through, the best way to take care of it is to talk about it. And that's something that it took me forever to understand. But I realize the beauty in that now. So I like to encourage as many people as I can to reach out to me and share whatever their struggles are.
Yeah, because the opposite of an addiction, it's not a sobriety, but it's connection.
Absolutely.
Yeah, lovely. You did the whole program, the 12-step program, it's a little bit the feeling like you did the 12-step with your book also, or?
Oh, man, I don't know. You know, it's been an intense journey.
Yeah.
You know, the book just started out as, and you and I were talking about this briefly, but it just started out as, you know, I'm in rehab and they're asking me to journal. And you know, I kind of rolled my eyes at that. I was like, yeah, okay, fine.
Like coloring, all that stuff. Yeah.
How stupid is this? That's what I thought. And, you know, by the second day, I couldn't stop writing. And it started to wake me up to all different things that happened in my life, but it started to help me connect some dots from my career, from different people who have come in out of my life, from my childhood, what my family is like. You know, when you're writing, I feel like for me, a lot more comes out than when I'm just talking. And, you know, a lot more of my past came out from writing. And so that journaling continued all the way through rehab, through my first couple years out of rehab, and still continues today. I journal almost every morning.
Yeah, because what I liked about your book is you're going back 25 years in time. Pretty confronting, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, there's so many things that have happened in my life that I never stopped to look at or think about or thought had any significance. And, you know, in writing the book, I recognized how many things really impacted me. And maybe some of them I buried. Maybe some of them I just didn't pay attention to, or, you know, I just didn't give any time to. But I did so much of that in my life, not giving time to things or people for that matter. And so writing it uncovered a lot of that.
Like you said a minute ago, I'm not that a talker, but the writing helped me a lot. But you're a dancer. Did you put your emotion, all your emotion in your dances, I think? Or
no, you know, that's strangely enough, one of the things I've learned in the last couple of years is that I don't think I ever really loved dancing that much. I liked it. I liked it a lot, and I was good at it. So that's what led me to have a career in it. But I don't think I ever had that passion or love for it that I see other people have, other dancers that I've been surrounded by or other people that I've watched, where you can just feel their love, their passion. I don't think I ever had that.
Wow.
So I don't think, you know, when you say, did I put my emotions into my dance? I don't think I did. I think I did it as a job. I did it as a way to make money. It was a hobby. I enjoyed it. I met a lot of people. I met a lot of girls.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's as far as it went for me. I don't think it fulfilled me. I don't think it's what I wanted to do or was meant to do.
It's a little bit, how you say it, because when I read the book, I see a lot of discipline. It's a word that comes again and again, because you had the discipline to dance, mm-hmm. to stood up every morning, to go training, but not the discipline to quit drinking, mm-hmm. correct?
Yeah.
Because the break was broken?
Well, that's what was so frustrating
yeah.
about it. That's what pissed me off about drinking so much, is that why couldn't I control it? I couldn't wrap my head around that. I couldn't understand it because I showed discipline in every other yeah. aspect of my life. Everything from getting up in the morning and working out to what I ate to showing up on time everywhere I had to go, to every job, everything. But when it came to alcohol, no discipline.
No discipline.
It really did. It pissed me off. But I was determined. That's what's so messed up about it. Is like instead of walking away from it, I was determined to figure out how I could enforce discipline on my drinking. And every day I thought I could.
Maybe the disappointment, it's a circle. You couldn't do it. Then you're drinking again and again. It's like a circle you get in.
Absolutely.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah. And I felt it every night. Right? Because every day I woke up and I said, okay, today's going to be different. You know, and alcoholics know this very well.
Yeah.
But today's going to be the day that I, not necessarily quit, but that I cut back. I'm going to drink less. I'm going to drink responsibly. And I meant it when I said it. But within hours, that was gone.
Okay. So, but you had a few wake-up calls, like car accident.
I had a lot of wake-up calls. Because, yes, I mean, I had multiple incidents in my car. Not necessarily accidents with other cars, but me hitting things, hitting curbs, hitting dividers, almost killing myself. I got, you know, DUIs, a DUI, which I don't know if you call it the same here, but it's like driving,
yeah, we call it
drinking and driving, which I did all the time. Yeah. You know, I'm very fortunate that I didn't kill myself or somebody else.
Yes.
But also embarrassing situations, you know, at parties, getting drunk, you know, embarrassing my wife, and then blackouts, right? An endless string of blackouts from the time I was 14 years old. But I didn't think there was anything wrong with it. I just thought that that's how you drink. That's having fun.
But that's how we grew up, and we all started social, like for a social activity, yeah?
Yeah.
That's right. It's normal in this society.
No? Totally normal.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it was okay. I think for me, though, for some reason, because, you know, there were times where I had friends who drank like I did in high school and passed out the way I did, but then they didn't do it the next time. But I did. I did it every time.
Yeah.
It's the only way I knew how to drink. It's the only way I wanted to drink. I never understood someone who would have two drinks and call it a night. What's the point of drinking then? You know,
you go all the way.
Yeah. Well, if I wanted to drink something for the taste of it, I drink a Coca-Cola or something like that. No, I'm drinking beer or vodka or whatever. I'm drinking to get drunk.
Yeah.
That was the point.
Drink to get drunk. Yeah.
That's it.
And at some point, you also, we are children of the 90s, you have a cross addiction also. You used cocaine too. Mm-hmm. Did you feel you could drink more with the cocaine?
Well, hell yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, I didn't.
I'm not an expert, but I'm just asking I didn't for a friend.
I didn't discover cocaine. for a friend, okay. Well, you can let your friend know.
Hi, Evie. It's okay.
There was, I didn't discover cocaine, I think, until I was probably in my late 20s, kind of mid to late 20s.
Luckily.
I had used ecstasy way earlier than that. I started using ecstasy in college and in my early 20s a lot. But then the cocaine came later on, but it allowed me to drink even more. It was like start the night drinking or whatever, and then at a certain point, okay, now break out the cocaine. And it just turned things up a notch for me. I guess the gift or curse, you know, but the gift for me was when I did cocaine, it was obvious. There was no hiding it. I would rub my hands, rub my head, grind my teeth, make weird faces. Like there was no hiding that I was on cocaine, so I had to be very careful who I did it around, how much I did, how often I did it. I couldn't, and cocaine's not acceptable like alcohol is,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So I would have been a coke addict, but I couldn't get away with it the same way. So I couldn't hide it.
So you choose alcohol.
So I stuck with the booze, yeah.
Yeah, the booze. Do you think also to quit booze, it's more difficult to quit with the cocaine?
Oh, that's a good. Well, I think it's more difficult because it's so widely accepted. It's everywhere. So physically, is it more difficult? I don't know. I don't think I could answer that question. I'm not an expert like that. But I can tell you that booze is everywhere. You know, you and I want to have a coffee downstairs, yeah, but we're surrounded by people drinking beer. And more power to them. Like there's nothing wrong with what they're doing. You can't get away from it. And if you watch TV or movies or whatever, good luck watching a show that doesn't have multiple scenes of people drinking in it. Commercials, you know, everything, everywhere you go, it's there. It's really built its way into our culture. So I think, you know, quitting alcohol is so difficult because it's everywhere around you.
Yeah, but even your body give you signs, your hands. Can I feel your hands now?
Well, they're cold.
Cold, but not wet?
Well, that's in my book.
Yeah, that's in your book. Yeah. I read it.
So that wasn't about drinking. The drinking made that worse. But I had something. You're like one of the first people to ask me about this. Nobody asks about this, which I find interesting because for me, that was one of the most difficult things to put in the book, mm-hmm, because it's really a source of shame still for me. I'm embarrassed of it. But I developed this thing called hyperhidrosis where I had severe hand sweating, and that just made like my, it was kind of, you know, I do laugh because it was ridiculous. It was my anxiety would make my hands sweat. My hand sweating would push my anxiety and would make my hands sweat more. And it was just like this nasty, nasty thing. And there was no controlling it. It came on in my late 20s. It got worse in my early 30s. And it got to the point where I wouldn't have come in to do this podcast today. I would not have done it because I would have had to say hello and shake your hand. So I wouldn't do it. I avoided every situation where I would have to make contact with people because it was so embarrassing. Guess what took it away?
Yeah.
Drinking.
Yeah.
By my third drink, hands went dry. So I loved that. So not only did I want to drink because I was an alcoholic, but that was also the cure for my wet hands. Of course, it made it worse because when I would wake up in the morning, higher anxiety from the booze, wetter hands, it was a disaster. But I got stuck in that spin cycle for a long time.
Yeah, and the anxiety and the panic attacks, I was surprised because everybody knows you from TV, he's social, he looks like the perfect, you know, the typical.
I fooled everybody.
Yeah, you fooled everybody. Yeah, that's so nice that you like you said, if I'm being honest, everybody expecting you to be perfect, that make it more, the pressure higher and higher. And you, like the social events, you didn't do it. Even that, you get panic attacks for it, from it. Even the birthday of a friend, you didn't go.
No. No, it's, you know, the you know, did people expect me to be perfect? I think I did that to myself.
Okay.
I think people came to expect it after a while, but it's because that's what I wanted them to think. I made people think that in the way I talked, in the way I acted, the things I posted on social media. I made everyone think that my life was perfect and it was anything but. But I, that was my own doing. The social anxiety, I mean, I think I have similar social anxiety to most people, right? I think a lot of people are uncomfortable walking into a crowded room. I just never learned how to deal with that. Even at a young age, it's like I wouldn't go to a party or go somewhere if there wasn't going to be drinking. Why would I go there? I wanted nothing to do with it. So I never learned how to handle myself sober in those situations. And so that only increased as situations got bigger. I was going to bigger events, things that are, you know, more important, or more important people in the room, or whatever it may be. As situations increased, my anxiety only increased, and I had no tools for how to handle it. None. Other than drink. So if I was going to go somewhere, I would make sure I drank a little bit before I went. You know, otherwise I wasn't going.
But you drink totally blackout, because some scientists in America, they link our personality when we get drunk. They say you become a Mary Poppins, like me, for example, when you're social, more social. I think you became more like in Hemingway, small, you want to be by your own.
Yeah, well, I was like the guy that stands in the corner.
Yeah.
You know, it's I did not want to be in the mix at all. I just was not comfortable.
Like the story with Prince, I was waiting while you were writing, and then I took the stage.
My turn.
Yeah, no,
you know, all of those nights, it was very strange how I could go on stage and perform in front of all of Radio City Music Hall, right? And what I know are, you know, tens of millions of people watching at home on TV, but I walk into that club or something, and I want to shrink into the corner and not be seen and just have my drink and watch. And again, it was like I missed out on so many fantastic opportunities in my life because of that. Fun, interesting, dramatic, whatever you want to say, all of these different events and opportunities that presented themselves to me and people, and I avoided all of it. And, you know, it's disappointing to, you know, sit here and think about, because I had this somewhat fantastic life, which I'm still very, you know, I look back on as very fortunate to have lived, but I built no relationships. I have no lasting friendships. I did not make the most out of any of it. Even when I think about, you know, if we're going to talk about just coming here, coming to Belgium, all those years that I did So You Think You Can Dance and I did Belgium's Got Talent, and, you know, very few friendships or, you know, lasting relationships or even experiences going out and experiencing what the country has to offer. I didn't do any of it because I was more concerned with, you know, shrinking back into my hotel room and just having some drinks by myself and avoiding everybody.
Not now anymore.
Not anymore.
So the alcohol always take it over when you go to a social event. You go to social events now, or just you're looking for different things to do? Or because you said in the beginning, dancing, it's not my passion. You're still going to be a choreographer?
Me.
Yeah, thank you very much, Dan.
I am. Okay, so when I first got out of rehab and for the first year to year and a half, I didn't go out much at all. I didn't know what I could and couldn't handle, so I was being very careful. Now I go out. Not a lot. I'm not like a social butterfly, you know? That's my wife. That's not me. But I make a point of, hey, I'm not going to just sit in my hotel room. I'm going to go do some things. So I went to a concert the other day. You know, my wife and I go to comedy clubs and things like that. You know, I try to find different events to go to because I want to be out there. I don't like to be in the middle of the room and talking to a million people. That's not who I am. It's not what I want. But I do like to be out and experience things a little bit more. So I am seeking that stuff out more than I ever did before.
But in the moment.
But in the moment, yeah.
In the present.
Yeah. And I'm enjoying it. I'm definitely enjoying it. I don't want to be the center of attention. You know, I'm not, you know, looking to be anything like that. But you know, get more out of life. There's more to life than just, you know, sitting in your hotel room watching television.
That's true. That's yeah. why we're here.
Yes.
Is there a little devil on your shoulder still like talking to you? There's a little craving because you're now sober for almost 2 years, I think.
Almost three.
Three? Oh, excuse me.
Yeah. Hey, don't shortchange me like that. Come on.
I'm sorry for that.
No devil.
Or something else you talk to?
No, you know, I'm obsessed. You know, I still have an addict brain. That's not going away. So it's just where do I push that that energy towards? So I'm a little crazy with my fitness now, running marathons, doing an Ironman, all that kind of stuff. So that occupies a lot of my time. I'm not looking for. I don't have any cravings. I don't have anything like that. I'm just trying to consciously make decisions of trying new things. And again, not accepting, hey, it's easy for me just to stay by myself tonight or not do anything. But it takes effort for me to do some stuff. You know, my natural knee jerk all the time is, and just stay here and do
balance.
Nothing.
Balance.
You know? Yeah. And so it's just trying to go out there and do some stuff, live a little bit more, not just for me, but for the people around me too, for my kids, for my wife. Just try to, you know, get as much as I can out of life.
Yeah. Because for your wife, it wasn't be easy. Let's talk about that.
She deserves an award.
Listen, Natasha.
Dealing with me. I mean, the fact that she stuck around. Is
don't make me cry.
I cry when I think about, you know, it's when she dropped me off at rehab. I was terrified to get out of that car because I didn't think she was coming back, you know, and when she did, when she pulled back up those 31 days later to pick me up, I couldn't believe it. And I was over the moon. But she stuck by me. But what's amazing now is even the continued support of allowing me to put my sobriety first. You know, there are certain things I need to do every day and selfishly I need to do them every day in order to stay sober. There are certain things that I'm going to say no to that she wants to do, people she wants to hang out with that I say no to. All kinds of stuff. And she still is on board with that. I think it's incredible.
It's because beautiful.
I admit, and I've admitted this to her and she knows, if roles were reversed, I would have walked away. I wouldn't have stuck.
Whoa, that's hard.
And because I wouldn't.
You say
because
that
now. A selfish side of me would have said, I'm not dealing with this. This isn't fair to me. I'm moving on. And she had every right to do that, and she didn't, which I think is incredible.
Wow, beautiful. Now, you told me you were seeking for help. How you started your in Google, or you read a book, and you said, now I go over there or there. How you find help? Because you didn't go to a very expensive resort or something like that? No.
No. When I said to Natasha...
You're laughing with my English now.
Yeah, a little bit. I knew what you were trying to say. I got it.
You see me struggling? Yeah. And ask the question.
I tried to cut it off because when I walked into that room and told Natasha... I can't figure this thing out. I need help. Mm-hmm. That was it, right? And I regretted saying that to her. 5 minutes later, I was like, oh, shit. No, I'm okay. I'll figure it out. But it was too late. She was already searching for a rehab for me to go to. But we talked about it, and I said...
No Club Med for you?
I don't want to go to Club Med. Yeah. I don't want... Because if you put me in some 5-star hotel, I mean, that's what I've been doing. That's not going to help me. It's... My entitlement drove my drinking in my later years of drinking. I felt like I deserved it. Look how great I'm doing. Look how much money I'm making. Look at the vacations we're going on and the cars I'm driving and the house we live in. And that made me feel like I deserve this. I have every right to do this. And you put me in some, 5-star rehab facility, I'm going to feel the same way. Like, well, look, yeah, I'm in rehab, but I'm not really in rehab, you know? At the same time, I didn't want to go to a dump because I would have walked out after 3 days. You know, I wouldn't have lasted very long. So I said, let's just find some middle of the road place that is clean, but that is going to be all about recovery. Nothing else. No frills. I don't need to be swimming in a pool or eating steak at night. It should be pretty tough. And that's Natasha found it.
Nice.
Yeah.
Did it feel like a grief process? Like you lost your best friend, where you share your moments with?
I didn't feel like it. I did lose my best friend. Yeah. It's, alcohol had really become the thing that was with me. Happy, sad, lonely, celebrate, everything. Everything good that happened to me, bad that happened to me, anything. Alcohol was with me. And I didn't know how to function without it. And so I really thought by accepting that I had to go to rehab, I thought I had accepted that I was giving up my life. I was giving up fun. It was over. I'm never going to drink again for my wife's sake and for my kids' sake. But for me, it's over. And that's how I felt going in. And it was a bit of a grieving process. I was sad. I drank on my way to rehab. My wife's driving the car and I'm drinking beers in the passenger seat because that was my last hurrah. This is my last chance to drink. I couldn't believe it. I didn't know how I was going to do it without. But I found out really quick in rehab that, no. I'm going to be able to laugh again. I'm going to be able to have fun again. I'm actually going to be able to have more fun than when I'm drinking because drinking wasn't fun anymore. That's what's so crazy about it is...
It starts for fun, but it ends up...
I hated drinking. Like somebody said this in a meeting one time to me and it really resonated. It said, thank God I got sober because I no longer have to drink the warm vodka under my passenger seat. And I was like, oh my God, that's so true. I didn't even like drinking anymore. I just didn't know how to do anything without it. So it controlled everything I did. I made sure... No matter what I had to do each day, I had to plan how I was going to drink before, after, during. All it was a full-time job, but I didn't enjoy it. I felt like shit all the time. There was never enough. The good feeling that I could get from alcohol would last for about 15 minutes, 20 minutes. It's like I felt awful because I was going through withdrawal from the night before. Then I would start drinking, okay, a little bit more, okay. Then I would hit that quote-unquote sweet spot for about 10 or 15 minutes. That would feel good. I would feel normal again, and then gone. And then it was just, I need more blackout.
Yeah.
What fun is that? And yet I was thinking I was never going to have fun again because I was giving that up.
Yeah, but first you try therapy by a therapist. You go.
Well, yeah, what a joke that was.
Yeah, yeah. But because to know is to recognize, and that's the difference between the recovery. You're between people who recognize your problem, correct?
Yeah.
And you can share with.
Yeah, it's like I don't knock therapy. I think you know therapy is huge for a lot of people, but as I say in the book, therapy only works if you are being honest with your therapist.
Yes.
And it's, you know, I offered up half truths and, you know, and so the therapist is trying to help me, but they couldn't help me because they didn't even know what my problem was, how bad my problem was, because I wasn't telling them everything, you know. And when I got into rehab and I sat in these meetings with these guys, it's like, I say it like this in the book, I felt like I had found my people. I was like, oh, after all these years of thinking no one could possibly understand what it's like to be me, I was like, everybody knows. All these guys get it. They know exactly how I feel, where I'm coming from, and I know how they feel too. And it's like instant connection. And they learned from me. I learned from them. And it was like this whole new way of living opened up to me.
Lovely.
Yeah.
When I hear you say the discipline and in whole of the story, you couldn't say no. You couldn't say no to the booze. Are you a people pleaser? Did you felt like that?
No, no way. No one's ever asked me that, but no way.
No, it's because of many. No?
No way was I a people pleaser.
No, the reason why I ask you that, because you did an interview for Men's Health, correct? And it's like, okay.
Yeah, by the way, I was probably drinking while I did that interview.
Yeah, crazy. So like you say, yes, I take this chance, I go for it. And then the confirmation, everybody say, I do it good. And then party, drinking, correct?
Yeah.
And then I was thinking the confirmation, you're looking this confirmation not by yourself, but by other people. So that's the link why I ask you this question.
Yeah.
From people, please. You understand?
Yeah, no, I understand. But I wasn't a people pleaser. I was a people fooler, right? So it felt good when I kept everybody thinking that everything was perfect, right? Where when I kept that narrative alive. So by being in Men's Health, I mean, think of the irony of that. I was on the cover of Men's Health as an alcoholic, you know?
High function.
I was sober when I was sober on the day of that shoot, but I probably was drinking when I did that interview. Like, how messed up is that? But that was one of those things that I did that made everybody think, this guy's got it all. He's all together. Look at him on top of the beautiful wife and the kids and the house and the car and the vacations. And he's got a six pack and he's in great shape. And you know, it's like, it was just another thing that I was able to push in front of people and say, see how good I'm doing? That's what I got off on, is people patting me on the back saying, yeah, you're doing great. And then I would tell myself, I am doing great. You know, even, and it was a way for me to justify, I can drink like this.
Yeah, it's like the biggest group, the high function drinkers.
Yeah.
Alcoholists.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They are the ones that can hide it the best because they show you, you know, look how great everything is around me. Mm-hmm. And I can't believe how many people have come forward to me who work in finance, you know, and on Wall Street and in advertising and all these different walks of life. And I'm talking CEOs and, you know, really successful, quote unquote, successful people who have said to me, I got a serious drinking problem. And it shocks me. And it's funny, it shouldn't shock me because I know exactly what it's like, but they fooled me too. You know, usually it's like takes one to know one kind of thing, but you know, they hide it really well with everything that they build up around them.
Yeah, we hide a lot, I think.
Yeah.
Because we also have a Facebook group and about approximately almost 1,600 people, very honest about their problems. And every day they're coming new, I think, by your book, your podcast, because you have a podcast too. Mm-hmm. We said it on the bar, the little stones.
Yeah. Say that in Dutch.
Steentjes verleggen. We make impact. It's okay. But there is, I think, how you say it in English?
The impact though that people are making. I know, like the reason I wrote the book, the reason I do the podcast, first of all, it's like therapy for me. My podcast is my favorite thing. And like even guesting on a podcast, getting to sit here and talk to you right now, this is a therapy session for me. It's fantastic.
Thank you.
I love that. But there were people before me, some very famous, some not famous at all, but who were willing to share their shit, who were willing to be open and public about what they went through. And hearing those people's stories made me believe that it was possible for me. It started in rehab, watching some documentaries of some people and even just the other guys in there sharing their stories of how they got sober. And I said, if they did it, maybe I can do it too. And that's what started me on my path to where I am now. And so if I can do that with my book and with my podcast, I mean, that's the best. It's like, yeah, the ego, I want a lot of people to listen to my podcast. I want a lot of people to buy my book, of course. But the emails I get from people about how it's helping them, either motivating them to stay sober or inspiring them to get sober, or even just to maybe take a longer look at their drinking habits, that's awesome. That's when I feel like I'm doing some good, you know, because for the longest time, it's like I've lived this life that I've been very fortunate to live, but I feel like it's been for me. It's been very selfish. I don't feel like I was doing anything for anybody else. And so to know that I'm having a little bit of an effect on people and putting something good out there feels really good.
They're like a love project.
Yeah. Well, it's just having some purpose.
Yeah.
You know, it's, I like to say, and I'm confident in saying this, like I feel like I have a gift for communication. And yet I only used it for the longest time to make money. I did it on the shows that they gave me to do so that they would pay me and I would take my check and I'd go home. You know, and what is that? You know, and that's fine. You know, we all need to work, we need to make money, support our families, that's fine. But what else can I do that's, you know, gonna have a longer lasting impact on people? And knowing that I'm trying to do that now feels really good.
I have a gift for communication too, but not in English.
It's not so bad.
No, but this is also an exercise for me because I do workshops, perfectionism with people.
Okay.
And this is a form of letting it go. You can make mistakes as much as you want.
Right.
So
yeah.
It's make me happy. So what makes you happy? What are your little, do you know hashtag happiness?
Yeah, like
this, the little ones?
I mean, that's easy. It's my kids.
Yeah.
You know, my kids make me so happy. What I learn from them and my relationship with them on a daily basis is off the charts. And, you know, I thought for a really long time that I was being a good dad. And I was trying to be. I was just so misguided. You know, I was there physically with them.
You made time, but you weren't in the moment.
I wasn't there. You know, I wasn't building any kind of relationship or connection with them. They didn't know who their dad was. You know, now they do. And they also know who their dad's trying to be. Like, one of my favorite things I do with them is I admit to them when I'm wrong. If I, you know, scold them for something or punish them for something or whatever, and then I recognize that maybe I shouldn't have done that, I admit to them that I was wrong and I apologize to them and I love that. And it almost surprises them for a minute, but I think they're learning from that too, that, hey, you don't always have to be right. You don't always have to be the one in charge or in power or, you know, and I feel like we're on like, yes, I am their parent, but we're also on an even playing field. You know, we learn from each other. And I think that's a great relationship.
And you talk to each other. I think in all your process, if I'm being honest, that was a little bit the issue that you didn't spoke out what your feelings were, correct?
Yeah, at all. You know, now maybe I over-communicate a little bit.
Oh, no, it's okay by me.
If I drive them crazy.
Don't speak English. It's okay for me.
But yeah, I mean, I talk a ton, you know, and I never get tired of it. I love it. So, you know, when you ask me what makes me happy, talking to people, which is so strange because I thought I had convinced myself that I was antisocial for the longest time, but it turns out I really enjoy people and talking to people, whether it's my kids and my wife or it's total strangers. I enjoy that. And then, you know, my obsession, as I said, my addiction that has gone, that I've pushed towards physical challenges, that makes me feel fantastic too. You know, it's my daily, whatever it is in the gym or going out for a crazy long run or training for the Ironman that I did, or, you know, that those are things that truly make me feel good every day. So I seek that out on a daily basis.
Yeah, that's good. But many people search for help and then it stops when they stop the recovery. But the real life, it's when you go back home with your children. So it's very good you find yourself obsessioned sportman.
Yeah. But, I think what's important, and so a lot of the guys that were in rehab that were there for the second, third, fourth time said to me, you know, there's no reason you can't be a first-time winner. And you don't have to come back here. And when they all told me why they ended up back there, it's because they got comfortable in their recovery and thought, I'm cool, I have this, and sort of slowly slid back into their old lives and eventually slid back into drinking again. And so I make a point of it to try to do some learning and some growing every single day. And that keeps me moving forward in my recovery. I mean, I don't like to use the word only, but I am only 2.5, almost 3 years mm-hmm. sober. I got a lifetime of learning here to go. And so I'm aware of that. So I try to make a point of it to keep moving forward every single day.
Yeah, nice. And we talked about communication. What would you say to your younger self when you're 15? What would you say today to him?
Mm.
Yes, this is a little bit therapy, my friend.
Yeah. Yeah. Talk to your friends. Talk to your brothers and sisters. You know, not just about sports and politics, but about what you feel like today. You know, you don't have to put on a show all the time.
Good one. Yeah. Makes me quiet. Not everybody can do that.
Yeah.
Okay. It feels a little bit like I'm here with Michael Jackson. Why I'm saying that, I don't gonna tell it because everybody have to read your book to know for that. You know what I mean?
About oh, I know
that,
what you mean. Yeah, yeah. Okay. I like that.
Okay.
Well, but that's one of those things that the book, I think, illustrates is that I got to meet and spend time with some amazing people in my life. And I never stopped to get the most out of that moment or out of that opportunity. They were always just fleeting, and I was always looking to what's next rather than enjoying where I was and what was actually happening for me, to me, around me. I missed so much. You know, it's like even this, like now sitting in here and having this conversation, like I don't care how long this conversation goes on for. Whatever the rest of my night holds, I'll get to it. It's fine. But in this time, I'm going to be here and speaking with you. And that's the biggest difference in my life now is wherever I'm supposed to be, I'm there at that time.
Did you feel, because in your book you talked about ego,
huh? Mm-hmm.
It crossed your path, and now I'm going to say another difficult word, gratitude and yeah. Nederigheid.
Character?
No, I know you have character. Uh-huh. Vulnerability?
Vulnerability.
Yeah, thank you.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's a brutal word.
That's like photographer.
Listen, that's English, and I stumble over that one all the time. Vulnerability.
You drink?
Yeah. It's fair. That's very fair.
I read that between the lines everywhere. Say the word?
Vulnerable. I'm vulnerable.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the best part about being vulnerable is people feel like they can be that way back to you. So the moment you show some vulnerability, people are more relaxed and feel like they can talk to you. and are more willing to talk to you about what's maybe not so perfect in their day. And today is that perfect example. I was at the Booktopia and I shared my story up there. And afterwards, I can't tell you how many people came up to me and felt like they wanted to share their stuff right back. And that was fantastic. I mean, that the whole day was worth it for that hour or 2 hours, however long it was, that people felt like they could come up to me and talk to me like that. I mean, that's huge. I never thought I would be that person for someone. All I wanted before was for you to come up and tell me how good I was doing and then move on, you know? And now I'm not just talking, I'm listening, which is way different for me, but way better.
Yeah, it suits you.
You think so?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah, okay. Absolutely. That's what I want to say. I don't really want to thank you for this difficult word. Say it again.
Vulnerability.
Yeah. Gratitude.
Yeah. Well, gratitude is like, I'm grateful for you reaching out to me and asking me to do this.
You were so long on my list. You know that?
I was what?
On my list.
So what took so long to ask me? Now I'm pissed off.
No, it has to feel the right moment, and I just feel the right moment. Yeah, it really is, because it's a process. Yeah. And for some reason, I don't know, and then it came the book, and I said, oh, maybe just now it's the moment I send an email. And you were so, vulnerable.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
Thank you very much.
It's getting better, yeah.
And I thought, because we moved sometimes, and every time you were replying, sorry for that. And I said, wow. And then I read the book. I started 2 days ago because I have to read the book before I do the interview.
Better.
Yeah. And normally adults have something unique as outro, like somebody reads something from the book, or they give me a poem, or they do a little dance, which we're not going to do.
So hell no.
Nope. We're not monkeys today. But then I read the book and I have another idea, but we keep that after the talk.
Oh, okay. You know, but the gratitude thing, I find gratitude in everything. So I make a gratitude list every night before I go to bed, and I do it with my kids as well. I just make my kids tell me right before they go to bed, tell me something you're grateful for today.
Love that.
And they say the funniest things, right?
like
sometimes they're really good things. They'll point out somebody in our family that did something for them that day, or something they experienced at school or whatever. But you know, sometimes my son is like, "I'm grateful for baseball," you know. Yeah. But that really means something to him right now. So I like for them to go to bed with their focus on something good in their life. You know, rather than worrying about the things that you don't have, focus on what you do have. You know, it's for myself, I was stuck so long because I had become so entitled and so materialistic because of that entitlement. I was always looking around at what everybody else had, you know, and I wanted more, or I needed more, something to make these negative feelings that I have away. Surely there's something I could buy or do that'll make it go away. Right. And man, I had everything I wanted right around me. And I have this incredible wife. I have these two awesome kids. I have a ton of family and friends around me that love me and support me. I have a great job. All this stuff. And I couldn't see it, you know, because I was so focused on what I didn't have or what somebody else had. And changing that focus and being grateful for.
Even a little bit grateful Corona came?
That's a very strange conversation for me to have, you know, because Corona ruined so many people's lives.
Yes.
And at first it looked like it was going to ruin my life too, but it saved me, flat out saved me. Because if it wasn't for Corona, I'll tell you right now, I'd be here right now in Belgium filming a show, and I would be in Amsterdam filming a show, whatever, and I would still be on this vicious cycle of drinking, but using the money and the shows and all of that to make you think I was okay. And I would wake up 10 years from now and realize that I was a mediocre dad and a shitty husband and a worthless friend. And what would I do then? It would be too late. And so I'm grateful for the pandemic shutting me down the way it did.
Okay. I want to thank you for your vulnerability, your gratitude, especially for your honesty, but most of all, for being you today, Daniel.
That's awesome. Thank you. Thank you for having me and letting me talk and making me laugh a little bit at the same time.
I try to. Yes. Thank you. You're welcome.